It's the resounding silence of a poetry book hitting the, hitting the world.
I'm fighting. It's like launching an oil tanker across the Atlantic. It takes a while to get going.
Great big crashing poems.
We don't read and write poetry because it's cute.
Not blubbering baby stuff.
Read and write poetry because we are members of the human race.
Like Oprah said, the road less traveled.
You know, that doesn't mean what everybody thinks of
it. Do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth?
And if you like it, I mean, if you like my poem, and if you feel that's something to your life in any way, then you can pay me whatever you feel like.
Oh, shit, we about to get educated.
Michelle here. Wanted to briefly introduce Dennis Camere, who I was lucky enough to get to talk to me for this first episode of the new iteration of the podcast. We talked about his new collection from Deerbrook Editions called Anthology of Awe and Wonder. It's new this year, hot off the press, and it is stunning. It is densely textured, it's joyful, it's funny, it's heartbreaking. It really showcases Dennis's distinctive voice and talent. I've known Dennis for many years, and I know no one like him. If you can hear him read his work, do it. It is a one-of-a-kind experience. You can catch him at Lewiston's Cafe Obscura Poetry Open Mic Night. That goes on every third Thursday, and he is the co-host of that. So that's an excellent way to catch him read a little bit of his work. He's also launching a new reading series in Bethel at the wonderful Gem Theater called Poetry in the Round Robin, so look out for that. A little more about Dennis, he's the author of Combed by Crows from Deerbrook Editions and Stone by Stone, Finishing Line Press. Wonderful books, both. He teaches and tutors writing at Central Maine Community College. Those in Maine may know him as the former director of Maine Poetry Central and the founder of the Portland Poet Laureate program. His work has appeared in many journals, Mid-American Review, Poetry East, Spoon River Review, Cafe Review. It's been featured on Maine Public Radio, and he is also the spokespoet of the mom and pop owned company Soil Foods, which farms worms for worm castings. I spoke with Dennis on Zoom. He was at his A-frame in West Paris, Maine, where he lives, and I asked him about his latest collection. So here's Dennis.
Writing is something we love. Why put the gun to your head? Yeah, writing is something we love to do. And so what I often do in my work is I try to explore things that make me see the world in a nuanced, beautiful, sublime manner, and that, you know, create a better, more joyful, delightful relationship with the world and with the self and with the human family. So I think the anthology, even though there are some sad poems, there's always something that we're like, that's beautiful in some way about how humans deal with X or Y. And so I think, you know, I put the poems together because they all help me to practice a more healthy mindfulness, maybe is what you could say. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm hoping, you know, after Claire read it, she said, you know, you experience the poems as much as you read them. And I'm just hoping that people, you know, they're not just reading them as poems, they're experiencing them and they're saying, you know, there might be a lot of beauty around us. And even with the foreboding upcoming election, the human family might still be pretty beautiful and mysterious and wonderful. And you know, maybe we should persist.
You mentioned about the sublime, and I thought about that too. When I was reading the book, I was thinking about going back to kind of one shyness and the sublime, which I hadn't thought about since graduate school. But I was thinking about, it occurred to me that there's something going on in the book where, you know, where, you know, if Plath has a poppy, it's because she's sort of putting an emotional, her emotions onto the poppy or whatnot. Yeah. And it struck me, you know, that you, what you were doing was when you have a poppy or a radish or whatever it is, that we're seeing that thing, like the thing has agency, that you, you know, and it, and it's not just a screen, you know, for our psychologies. It's sort of, you know, this just piece of furniture that in the world that we're, you know, that's helping us understand our inner lives. And I thought that that was really interesting. I thought it was kind of a radical thing to do, is to see the thing itself. Of course, it's mediated by humans. It has a relationship with humans, but it's, I think that's why the poems feel like a celebration. They're very empathic, and I went back and I looked at, talk a little bit about the challenges of that, of writing about the natural world, because I mean, I'm under that cloud, that kind of anxiety of influence about the natural world, natural phenomenon. If we write, you know, if we're right, bad poetry is usually about nature, not that we shouldn't continue on. But do you feel that challenge? And maybe you could say a little bit about what it's like to approach poems that have that as a focus. Not that every poem in this book does, but many obviously do. That's a thread that's kind of going through.
Yeah, well, I mean, first off, I don't think about, you know, I read The Anxiety of Influence and I thought it was great. It was brilliant. And I think Milan Kundera has a similar term. I think he calls it gramophobia, where... brilliant artists have to ignore other artists because in order to be a great artist, they have to create their own cosmos. And you can't create your own beautiful, intricate cosmos if you're aware of someone else's brilliant, intricate cosmos. So I remember The Anxiety of Influence, but I don't care. I don't try to constellate myself in a tradition. I have no desire to be anthologized by the Norton anthology. I'm just kind of writing, you know, when I write about nature, I'm just, I don't know. I mean, my first teacher was Wes McNear. And one of the first things we did in our workshop at UMF is he said, you know, you need to see the world through the eyes of a child. And he said, you know, that's what we're going to do. Let's pretend that you've never seen a toaster before. Let's pretend you've never seen a refrigerator before. And what I didn't realize is that he was really doing all the Thich Nhat Hanh beginner's mind Buddhist stuff, which I'm subsequently big into. And so I'm always conscious when I'm looking at nature. Let's look at a radish differently. Let's look at a rat, you know, and then, you know, I'm always kind of just looking for this beginner's mind and this fresh experience of something in the natural world, you know, instead of writing a lament about the rhododendrons getting eaten every winter by deer, I'm like, it's interesting that I see these rhododendron blooms in the fawn spots of the mother, you know, and suddenly a poem starts to happen. I mean, I think there are probably 8 poems where nature is consolation. I was very much influenced by Meister Eckhart, the 13th century mystic, who was excommunicated from the church, which means he was a really good dude, and he died awaiting sentencing. But I was really influenced by his book, The Divine Book of Consolation, which he wrote for one of the queens in a little fiefdom that he lived in when she lost her daughter, I believe. And apparently consolation literature was a subgenre as far back as the Greeks. But anyway, I got into this consolation literature 2 years ago. So you're going to find a lot of nature poems where a mother is, you know, her son killed himself and she's weeding her garden and she's thinking about her son's love of gardening. And suddenly writing about nature becomes interesting, you know, because nature is being used in some sort of healing, solace way. So some of my poems about nature are grounded in that approach, while others are just grounded in seeing nature from a playful, unique perspective and seeing what it might say to me or how it might unfold on its own terms.
Wow, that's so interesting. And I think that's where we're seeing kind of the shadow of that joy, I guess we were calling it before, kind of follow these poems around, because, I mean, of course, the constellation implies that there's some trauma or loss. Even just sort of saying, look at this thing, kind of implies that we were not looking at it. And it's almost like you're coming at the point where we're being consoled or finding some healing, whereas there's just kind of this understood precursor to the poem that we understand that exists. And I love that balance, that sort of that darkness we're feeling. I mean, it's why that kind of the wordplay, which people have brought up, I think, about this book, that it's kind of a playground sometimes of language. It's very fun and that playfulness with the language couldn't exist. You know, it would merely be funny or fun, mm-hmm. but instead it's kind of like the trellis for the pole bean of the poem to kind of bounce off of. And I think that's why it isn't strictly, you wouldn't say, oh, this is just such a fun, you know, it's just such a fun playground that he's working with. It has to have that dichotomy of darkness beneath it.
A lot of what I've done, I discovered, is written about in this book, Awe, the New Science of Everyday Wonder and How It Can Transform Your Life. And in this book, he talks about there are seven contexts to experience awe. And what I discovered, you know, because I had already pretty much put this manuscript together before I read the book, what I discovered is that my poems are usually in one of those seven contexts. So there's the awe of nature, right? You're typically, mm-hmm. you know, you're in front of a waterfall, you know, and yada, yada, and you have this great moment. Then there's the awe of moral beauty, which is like when we were watching Tiananmen Square and all of a sudden this guy stood in front of the tank. Suddenly, that's called effervescent awe. Well, that's the awe of moral beauty. Sorry. You see somebody do mm-hmm. something brave, courageous in the name of love and justice and humanity. Mm. So I got a few poems in there that are in that context. Then there's the awe that results from effervescent awe. So that an example of that would be you're at a Pink Floyd concert and everybody suddenly starts singing together. Mm. And you have this experience of unity and oneness. And so there's this effervescent communal awe. And then there's the awe of music. Mm. There's the awe of stories, okay? Awe of stories about love. And then there's the awe of stories about religion and spirituality. And I forget the seventh context, music, geometry. So anyway, a lot of the poems partake in one of those domains of awe. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm seeking to sometimes have the poem resonate with that particular awe. You see what I mean? Huh. So like in the scene, I Dog, you know, there's this gesture where this guy is really trying to, you know, get over the loss of his wife, but he is doing it through the lens of being this dog catcher and dog, you know what I mean? There's some gesture he makes to try to heal, which is really beautiful mm-hmm. and really makes you look at what he's doing in awe. So this poem was just inspired by something I heard on NPR years ago, and they were literally talking about how birds had abandoned their borders in a time of war. So the city under siege for years suddenly realizes that birds have abandoned their borders. By fall, they long for the abandoned nests, signifying a past gentleness that coax chickadees to mate by open windows, then perch on clotheslines. Soon, though, wagers are made on what species will be the first to signal a return to peace, biblical dove or regal eagle circling. Later, the town poet notes there's no word for a birdless world, but fails to gerrymander some grand Germanic polysyllabic verb for that epic lacking. Still, when it's learned Earth holds 62 birds per person, hope roosts on a professor's equation where peace is induced in restoring 20 or 30 birds per person within their borders. Slowly now, locals dream of amity restored by an amazing flock of peacocks parading down Main Street with their royal flush of tail feathers imbibed by the scopes of snipers and the binoculars of colonels. And mothers who've lost sons seek to heal by carving feeders and dreaming of a return of feathers slowly burying their grief. And imagine now how word passenger pigeons of a city where birds are barometers of peace, and hundreds of peaceniks wake, imitating the mating calls of sparrow, owl, or jay. And consider the loving intent in bird feeders topped with seed, waiting for wings to again heartbeat bay windows. And how lovely in this age of avian genocide for the picture books of birds to fly off shelves for children, who though yet to espy a single raven, thrush, or cardinal, still save us with their bird of paradise eyes flapping over the pages of herons and bobolinks, lit by the seamless light of a clear, abandoned blue sky.
The experience of hearing the poems and reading them are really different. Both are just have their own experience. I'm glad that people are going to be able to hear a little bit of you reading them, because it's just so one of the reasons is some of the poems, this one, is long. There are some of the poems in the book that are several pages long. It's not Dante's Inferno or anything, but they're lengthy poems, and not in just the length of the poem, but the way that they continue kind of in this relentless manner where they push through, with this kind of momentum where you might think that it would be, you would stop, we've got peacocks mm-hmm. walking down the street. Like we wouldn't think we would need a bobolink as well. We get that. It's so sort of Shakespearean where it's just, to be or not to be, and just looking at every angle of that and just keeping hammering going forward. And it almost makes me feel sometimes when that's happening in these poems that it's kind of like this kind of weird Andy Kaufman kind of thing where he gets on stage and just starts to sit down and starts to read Mice and Men or something, and it's confusing at first, and then it's really funny because it's like, oh, this is what's happening, and then it's not funny anymore because he's still doing it, but then it's funny again, in this new, even even more hilarious way, and it kind of pushes through that. That sounds like a terrible analogy, but that's kind of the feeling where it's the poems are kind of just, it feels improvisational in a way almost, but it's very disciplined. It's extremely crafted stuff, and it's just it kind of keeps going past where you find this other swell of joy for kind of getting to the next step there. And I see that a lot in some of these poems that, again, has a whole different experience when you're hearing it. And so wonderful. If you could talk about kind of this, what opportunities you find with length, with pushing past, if that's how you would also characterize it, what kind of opens up?
Basically, you know, that poem and many other poems like The Landscape Lexicographer Laments and The Black Bear Biologist. So quite a few of these poems are what I call expressionistic jazz riffs. So, you know, I'm not writing your typical linear narrative where you have this clear arc of conflict, rising action, you know, climax, falling action, resolution. A lot of these are, you know, and I'm certainly not a jazz expert at all. And I'm not saying I'm the Fats Waller or the verse or the, you know, but a lot of these poems are, they keep turning the same theme and exploring it in a different way. And rather than resolving it, I'm continuing to explore another incarnation of a theme while keeping the same general, you know. So I think, you know, I think thematically and in terms of form, there is an influence of jazz in that I'm not concerned with telling the clearest, shortest story. I'm also, you know, poetry is what I love to do. So when I find something beautiful that speaks to me, if I package it in a haiku, I've cheated myself. It's like all orgasm, no foreplay. You know what I mean? Poetry is something I love to do. So when I find a beautiful moment, a beautiful gesture that a speaker makes, or a beautiful experience, or I see a beautiful nature scene, or a beautiful story, I want to protract it and play it out like a jazz musician would interpret it, so that I can experience it more fully. I mean, you can't really decant awe in a haiku. You know, the nature of awe is celebratory, and it's hard to have a Dickinsonian way with language while doing justice to the amplified nature of awe. You see what I mean? So a lot of these longer poems and lines, I hope, do justice to the awe that I'm slowly unraveling.
There's a lot of poems in the book, Bake or the Dog Catcher, where there's they seem to have this approach. It could almost be a method. You know, it's like the duplex, or Jericho Brown's duplex, or Terrence's golden shovel, where we're kind of, it's kind of like this poem that maps a human, you know, foible or loss to a natural thing or some kind of a phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And then those things are braided together, again, like preserving that natural thing. Again, it's not a screen that we're putting our psychology on, but those things are sort of braided together. And I'm just, there are a lot of those. They're so interesting. Sometimes you appear in them as the speaker, or rather the speaker appears in the poem as an I. They're not persona poems necessarily. I'm wondering how you describe your approach to creating that poem.
That's a good question. I can say that 20 years ago, I read Spoon River Anthology. And in many of those, you know, those are monologues where each person in the town tells a story, a poem. And what you find is that many of these people in this town, they interpret their life via what they do as a job or what they do for a passion. So you have the fiddler's poem where he interprets his life through his fiddling and how that shaped his perspective on life. And there are a lot of poems in there where I was really intrigued at how, you know, someone who tans leather sort of interprets a lot of the world by that craft, or someone who plays fiddle interprets the world through that craft, or somebody who does, you know, like in this book, someone who's a biologist interprets the world through their particular passion in biology or something. You see what I mean? So some of the, I think, so like the Black Bear Biologist, you know, it's a story about a woman who, you know, is adopted and she's a warden. And I just thought, you know, this is, you know, I put together part of her story and then it went into my own thing. And, you know, it's just really interesting that somebody who's adopted and who doesn't know who her mother is or was taken from her mother, it's just interesting what happens to her when she takes the cubs from the mother. You know what I mean? I just thought that was such an interesting thing. And that's something that, you know, we tend, you know, fishermen look at a lot of things in life through the lens of what it means to be a fisherman. And, you know, we tend to look at and interpret our world through various lenses, and our profession or passion or hobby is often that lens. So I think the retired dog catcher, the Black Bear Biologist, and a number of other poems are, I'm doing that. I'm considering the world as seen through that particular lens. And it's really interesting to me.
In terms of the person that is, you're kind of embodying how they would see the world in that way. Very interesting. It takes some really interesting turns. I'm thinking of the bread baker, the father of conjoined twins kneading his bread as if, you know, that these two pieces, you know, are separated. And
but, you know, if, you know, as a bread baker, if you have conjoined twins, you automatically think of them every time two loaves cook together. Yeah, I mean, just it's something that happened. I'm just saying the you know, and connections aren't whimsical. They're actually there. We do experience our world through those.
Yeah, it's not kind of a magical scrim you're putting on it, but it's a way of seeing the world for through someone that's had an experience that's very difficult. Yeah, it's fascinating.
Okay, yeah, so Salmon Run. I wrote this because a friend of mine is from Vancouver and he teaches in New York. And when his father died, he went to Vancouver. And after the funeral, you know, it was the end of the Salmon Run and he was posting dead salmon on Facebook. So it's kind of his story.
Huh, wow.
Salmon Run. After 3,000 miles on the red eye, wrestling the jet stream's endless currents of turbulence, he arrives at his dad's funeral, feeling like an enervated sockeye. And like the fish amidst an Eden of insects, he doesn't eat from the endless hot dishes gifted from friends and neighbors. And seeking an opening for the eulogy, he scours his boyhood bedroom, then finding that photo of them beaming with his first caught cutthroat, feels like a sea-run salmon who swims miles of shoreline before scenting the stream where he was conceived. No wonder the son comes to believe he's half-man salmon. As in daydream, he can't stop nosing into grief's swift currents of memories and seeing in sorrow's pink eyes dying salmon. Now the man stays an extra day, hikes to the ancient salmon stream, and harvests a large male to fillet and dry in his dad's old smoker. Returned home, he thaws some red flesh when feeling lonely, then feels for his dad's gentle fly-tying fingers in the bones. And when his boy turns 10, they begin the annual migration to the same stream, where he feels secure over the sun shining and darting between rocks like a fingerling fattening for an adult life of salt water rife with famished seals and great whites. Here he praises the Native American salmon clans, proofing there's no separation between man, salmon, and creator. Here he prays that these spruce-lined banks, too, will hold so many memories of them, frying rainbows inside cast iron, before a night of fishing tales and tender advice about wading into the waters of desire. And may his future grief over my death, he thinks, be eased in him echoing to his son, his dad's words on the salmon gutted by grizzlies, reincarnating their nitrogen into fur needles and bald eagle wings swimming the breeze. And may I too pass when the stream is rife with the circle of life fish in the shallows, so inconsolable, he might too scoop up a dying man, smoke the flesh, and eating each future fillet, feel the salmon running his bloodstreams, miles of winding tributaries, until realizing his heart's own vast, magnificent watershed of the living.
Would you consider this fitting into one of the categories? Would this be a consolation?
This is kind of like moral beauty, I guess, in a way. Where, mm-hmm. Or it's more of a gesture, right? He's really exposing his son to something that is both beautiful and tragic as a means to steel him against his own pain. So it is, it's the awe of moral beauty here.
Mm.
Also thinking of a lot of Stephen Dobbins poems where I wanted to make this a story, I wanted to kind of have this be a more complete story. So there's some Stephen Dobbins, I hope, esque things going on in the middle where he goes home and, I keep pushing it. Okay, let's move this into the future more. Let's keep going into the future. I'm finishing an ode to salmon. I was working on it today and I'm very close to writing an ode to salmon.
Oh, wow.
It's an ode to their second migration. It's an ode that deals with a documentary about the salmon's, they have, their molecules are called molecule 5. And what they discover is that when beers drag them into the understory, their molecules seep into the ground, they're sucked into the trees, so they swim the meandering streams of roots up the waterfalls of trunks and swim in the canopy of the sea. And I'm just into this whole, it's an ode to the salmon second migration where it continues in all of these beings. And I think this poem maybe it's picking up where this poem left off.
I feel like there are people that don't know a lot about poetry. I always think that it doesn't have any of that kind of left brain stuff about it, whereas if we consider just the form and the meter and the prosody and all of that, all of these poems are based in something scientific or something that's the fact that we're 60 birds per human.
60 birds per person as of 5 or 6 years ago.
That poem is grounded in that fact, and this one is the one you're writing, it's grounded in that fact of what goes on there. That really appeals to me. I think that's the best poetry, where it really does trigger two sides of your brain.
Yeah, a lot of the poems do deal with science, like the science of bees. And yeah,
sure,
and,
yeah.
I'm trying to talk about the science in a way that isn't just all left brain. And yeah, I'm trying to bring, you know, awe to empiricism. You know what I mean?
Scientific
method meets the muse, and, you know.
I mean, it makes sense that it would enter into this discussion of kind of awe and wonder. And also, I think part of being able to talk about all of these big things is and have it be so successful in this book. I think it's really masterfully done in the tone. I think it's the tone of the book, in that you can say an awful lot when you have that. You know, I guess it's that negative capability where you as the speaker are open to understanding, and we discover it, as you know, with you, with the speaker each time. We're kind of coming to it together. I think that's just, that's the strongest voice for a poet, is to be not, you know, overly declarative, and have that kind of wonder kind of surging through. So we can experience it too.
I mean, it's definitely a non-denominational awe and wonder, right?
Yeah,
I mean, in the awe is seen in so many different contexts that you can't really pigeonhole it. You know, the awe of nature, the awe of moral beauty, the awe of, you know, there are so many different contexts that it's hard to put any of it in any sort of traditional religious, you know, discipline. Although, yeah, there are all kinds of Eastern influences and Western mystic influences. And yeah, I mean, that's kind of, it reflects who I think I am becoming. You know, I just see, all I'm doing, you know, this is what I was thinking about this podcast, like, you know, what am I doing? All I'm doing is I'm seeing so much beauty in the human family and in the earth around me. And I just have this overwhelming urge to want to recycle it in art. That's all I'm doing. That's all I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And that's all I want to do.
Pardon My French is produced by Michelle Lewis. Engineering and audio production by David Brubaker at Off Road Music Studio.